Hello, I'm Yolanda McFarlane. This is number 0175, the Stuff 5 program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0175. And this is a very special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know last week we had a special show too when we put together the annual broadcast of the Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is also rather unique. We've been doing the show for 3 years now, and I thought it was time to go back and revisit some of the interviews we've done during that time. In other words, a best-of show, replaying some highlights of the interviews over the years. Ones that I thought were fun or meant something special to me, or both. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition of the show. It's just going to be snippets of past programs. I think I will also revisit a favorite idiot of the day at the end of the show as well. The guest Slater, by the way, the person who told you this was show number 0175, was one of my own sisters, Yolanda McFarlane. She's always been a great big sis, and she's always been there for me, especially in my extremely young formative years. So thank you very much, Yolanda, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Anyway, let's get right to the meat of the program as we look back at some of the interviews done over the years on the Stuff File program. A show also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. First up is a portion of an interview that is very near and dear to me. It is with actress Yvette Nicole Brown, who is one of the stars of the hit NBC sitcom Community. This interview is special to me because back when I was starting this show, and it was just simply a podcast and nothing more, I didn't know if I would be getting the same quality and caliber of guests that I was accustomed to chatting with on my old radio show that was heard over the air in both Montreal and Toronto. But Yvette was an actress that I had interviewed previously years earlier, and when I contacted her to be a guest on what was then an early podcast of a program that had a yet-to-be-determined audience, she graciously agreed to appear as a guest. It's people like Yvette that helped this show to become a success right out of the gate, so I will always be indebted to her for her early appearance on the show. And speaking of early appearances, it was also near the beginning of her series Community. The show had only aired a couple of episodes at the time of this chat back on Stuff File number 0004. One of the things I asked her was, what was it like when she first came into contact with her fellow co-stars on Community?
You know, it was amazing from the beginning, and I've been blessed to work on a lot of shows and have had great experiences on sets, but I don't think I've ever gelled this quickly with a group of actors. Like, we're all unique and crazy in our own way, and silly in our own way, but everybody's silly meshes well with everybody else's silly, which is, you know, very unique. And so when we're doing a lot of the study room scenes where we're all around the table together, we just enjoy watching each other work. So we're just giggling at each other's silliness throughout the entire take.
I know the show's only been on for 2 episodes. You say you're only working on the 8th episode right now. It's a very short period of time. But in that short period of time, looking around the room at the cast of characters that you have, who would you say is most like their character, and who would you say is least like their character?
Oh, that's funny. The thing about our writers and our creator, Dan Harmon, that's great, is that he's really, the line between who we are as people and who these characters are, it's really blurred at this point, 8 shows in. So, sadly, we're all like our characters now, which I say sadly because, again, these characters, all the characters in the show are like a little crazy, and we as human beings are all a little crazy. So I would say the most like the character is probably Joel, because Joel is very, he's like the snarkiest, nice person you'll ever meet. So he always has like a little smart alecky comment, but he's so charming and cute that you let it pass. And so he's probably the most like his character, except that he has more heart than Jeff Winger does.
Ah, okay. Now, in looking around and seeing how the show has progressed in the time that you've been on it, can you see yourself literally saying, I mean, assuming that it's a hit and it goes on, can you see a long run in this? Can you do you feel comfortable with these characters that you could play them for several years?
I definitely feel comfortable with the actors and the writers and the directors, and I would want to be on this show for as many years as the viewing public will let us. And I do think that there's enough leg, there's legs to this show because everybody, we have every race, every gender, every age group represented, and, you know, everybody comes from a different segment of society. So there's, like, so many different ways that the show could go. So I hope that it could be on for years and years, and if it is, I definitely would love to be a part of it.
You, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're a character actress, and you've been in so many television shows and every second commercial. I'm just wondering now, but it's a situation where I'm sure people don't necessarily know the name Yvette Nicole Brown because of the diversity of roles and the character acting that you've done. Is that starting to change for you?
That's definitely changing for me. I was in New York recently, and I was flying back and coming to the security, and one of the TSA officers called me by name, and I'm thinking, that's weird because I didn't show my ID or anything going through the metal detector, and I realized, oh my God, he recognized me from the credit of the show. Like, that's the only way he would be able to connect my name and my face. So apparently he saw my name in the credits of the show and knew who I was, and he said, Yvette, I love Community. And I was like, wow, okay, I'm not Hey You or Aren't You the Girl From. I actually know my name now, which is very new to me and very nice.
Yeah, you were in New York recently, and I was reading one of your tweets that you were in the audience at The View.
Yes, Joel McHale was doing The View, and I'm friends with Sherry Shepherd, and I was actually in New York for that week to hang out with Sherry and go as she did her new show. She's got a new show on Lifetime called Sherry, and I was going to kind of hang out with her, and they were kind enough to put me in the audience, and right before the show ended, Barbara Walters said my name, and the camera caught a shot of me behind the ladies on the big screen. I'm like, my life is so surreal right now. And I have to thank Whoopi Goldberg for that, actually, because Whoopi was like, you know, we didn't get a shot of Yvette. And I'm like, I can't believe, first of all, that Whoopi Goldberg even knows who I am and that she would be kind enough to make sure that, you know, my face made it on while Joel was on the show. So I'm really grateful to Whoopi for that. And she's a sweetie pie, and Sherry and everybody are just great on The View.
When it comes to actors and actresses, people seem to get people confused all the time. You mentioned that you're a good friend of Sherry Shepherd, and you're both very funny women, both actresses. Have you ever been confused for each other?
Me and Sherry are confused for each other all the time. I've been with Sherry, and someone said to me, I love you on The View. I'm like, really? That's interesting, because she's right next to me. That's really interesting. So I don't know if it's weird. I don't know if we just look that much alike, or if we just have the same energy, but people always think that she's on Drake and Josh, and they always think I'm on The View. And hopefully now that I'm on Community, they'll be able to differentiate the two of us.
One of the other things, I mean, you're on many of the social networking platforms out there, and one of the things I've always noticed, your comments in the social networking platforms are always so positive, which is so great to see.
You know what? I've been so blessed, and I feel like if you're blessed with an opportunity to be in front of a lot of people, and they happen to listen to you, you should have something good to say. So, and you know, I'm a Christian, so every time I get a chance to remind people how much God loves them and that good things are coming their way, I take that. And so I don't use Twitter or Facebook to go, hey, look at me, I'm fabulous. I use it to go, God thinks you're fabulous. Mm. And so if anybody can go to my page and be encouraged or reminded of the way he feels about them, then I think that's the purpose of me having however many followers or friends or whatever the term is on the other site. So that's what I use it for.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Yvette, for coming on to this humble little podcast in its beginnings. I thank you for taking the time to chat with us once again.
I'm honored, and I will say this publicly on your podcast. I've been interviewed by a lot of people, and you truly are the tops. So anytime you need me, I'm there.
That was the wonderfully sweet and talented Yvette Nicole Brown, who was one of the first guests on an early Stuff File program. She is one of the stars of NBC's Community, which is going into its fourth season. And don't forget to check out her Twitter and Facebook as well. You'll find the links on my website at thestufffile.com. Up next is one of the quirky kinds of interviews I also like to do. We met a guy who trains llamas to serve as caddies for golfers. Back on Stuff File number 0005, we spoke to Mark English, the president of Llama Caddy. I started by asking him how he got the idea of using llamas, or any animal for that matter, as a caddy?
Well, I had the idea 20 years ago, and it's taken me that long to put it all together. I'm in the turfgrass management business, so I've been around golf courses all my life. And like I said, wanted to do it for 20 years, but there's a lot involved. You got to have a place to keep them. You got to have the time to take care of them. You got to have a course that will allow you to bring them out there. And all together, and it's just been really a special, great thing.
Well, what has been the biggest hurdle? Was it a situation where golf courses might not consider allowing an animal like a llama on their course?
That was easier than I thought. Once they see it, they're going with it. The biggest thing was just, you know, committing the time to do it.
Now, have you had any complaints from, say, human caddies who are thinking that their business is going literally to the llamas?
No, human caddies is a rarity. I mean, you very rarely see it. I did it as a kid at Wilmington, Delaware. So I have some background in that, but that's something you very rarely see. So, no problems there.
Now, what makes a llama particularly suited to being a caddy? Is it the temperament of the animal?
I'm going to give the temperament the number one thing. They give you a nice, calm, peaceful feeling, and they're not in any rush, and they're not in any hurry, and just a positive vibe altogether. And then there's a lot of things about them that just make them great. They have a soft pad on their feet. They can walk across the green. We don't, but they can, and they leave no trace. The whole potty routine is amazing. We take the llama beans, that's the manure from the farm, bring it out to a designated area where the superintendent says it's okay, and actually walk them over to those beans, and they go right there. And we do 9 holes and go back to that same spot and go again, and not a problem.
So the llamas are literally potty trained?
They're literally potty trained, yeah. And then they're hypoallergenic, so there's no problem with that. Nice and clean, and very quiet. They'll make a little hum noise when we separate the groups, but it's not that bad.
Now,
just a great personality, great temperament. And what I've enjoyed the most is watching the different types of golfers. You know, you'll have some golfers that just go absolutely nuts over the llamas and could care less about the golf. They just want to hold them and pet them and walk them. And then you'll have the other golfer that, you know, I tend to see the better golfers really get excited about the fact that they've got a human caddy there helping them. That's something that, you know, is rare.
Well, I was about to ask, you're not about to get any golf tips from a llama.
No, but we supply handlers to go along with the groups, and they'll help you as much as you want.
Okay. Now, has having a llama as a caddy done anything to improve somebody's game? Are they more calm? Are they more serene?
More serene. Oh, yeah. Everybody's got their right attitude going. And what we're seeing also is just people that would even be interested in coming out to play golf are coming out to play. So, and a lot of kids and a lot of older folks really like it, too. We're seeing younger kids and older folks just are amazed. They're just mesmerized by the animals.
And do you ever have a situation where somebody says, I don't know if you've named them all, but I want Fred the llama because I like
Fred.
Oh,
yeah. Well, right now, in the very beginning, you, the man, was the main draw. And now I think Legend's kind of taken over as the king. He's our alpha llama. And he stands up real proud and tall, and everybody seems to like him the best. But, no, we have requests almost all the time. We had one boy all summer long, but every Tuesday he took Lightning out with him. So we've had situations like that as well.
Do llamas recognize?
He's a 4-year-old kid, and he needs Lightning all by himself. You know, we stay there and help, but in general he does it all himself.
Do llamas know people? Do they recognize people who golf regularly?
I think they do, yes. I mean, they know me, that's for sure.
They're all male. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, females spontaneously ovulate. So you can imagine what happens there. So it's either you keep males or you keep females. And we went with the males, and so far so good. Knock on wood. They've done really well.
You know, a lot of people
have quite a band of boys.
A lot of people will make all kinds of excuses as to why they've had a bad golf game, and usually they're lies. But I don't think the lie of, well, I was stricken by an ovulating llama has ever come up before.
Never heard that one.
Okay.
That would be a first.
Mark English, president of Llama Caddy. You can check out the website at www.llamacaddy.com. Going back to television, we spoke with another young star of a show that was just getting on the air. Back on Stuff File number 0006, we spoke to Naya Rivera, one of the stars of Glee. She plays Santana Lopez, who is one of the cheerleaders on the show, and of course, she's one of the many accomplished singers that program has. Here's a bit of that interview now. Everyone likes to pigeonhole shows, and when somebody says, oh, there's a television series that's coming on, and it involves a lot of singing and dancing, people like to look back in history to see what succeeded and what hasn't, and in television, not a lot has. And the first thing that comes up is, it's cop rock again.
Yeah, I hear that all the time. And I, like, didn't even know what cop rock was. And I did my research, and I'm like, this is nothing like Glee. But yeah, we get a lot of comparisons to things like that, and, you know, the High School Musical question comes up all the time, but I think that people have really had a chance now to see that it is unlike anything that's ever been done before, and just because it does have some of those same elements, you know, singing and dancing in high school, doesn't necessarily make it a hit like High School Musical or a failure like cop rock.
Right.
And I think that you really kind of have to make that judgment for yourself, and I think that they have.
The character you play on the show, as I mentioned, is Santana Lopez. She is one of the cheerleaders, and they're not the nicest girls in the group, the cheerleaders, and I'm just wondering if you've ever come across people like that in your real life.
Yeah, I definitely have. You know, I went to high school just like everyone else, and I had popularity issues with popular girls and whatnot, and yeah, I have, but I draw from that and put that into how I play my character, how I play Santana. And I guess you could say that that was a major blessing.
Does it worry you or concern you? Because, you know, sometimes people have a difficult time when you're out in public dividing an actor from their character. Are you concerned that people might think you're like Santana, which I'm assuming you are not?
Yeah, no, I'm not like her. I'm not that rude. I don't think that people would, I'm not concerned with that. I don't think that people would have a problem thinking that I'm like that in real life. I think that, you know, the show as a whole really pokes fun at the stereotypes of high school. I think that people get that. So I don't think that, you know, there isn't going to be any problem distinguishing me from Santana.
A show like Glee, an hour-long comedy, which has a lot of musical elements in it, a lot of production numbers, what's it like putting that show together on a weekly basis? It must be a very tight schedule.
It is. It's very tight. And we do cram a lot into a small amount of time. We have dance rehearsals and pre-records, and not to mention, you know, rehearsing scenes regularly like any other episodic television show. But it takes about 2 to 2.5 weeks to shoot each episode. And it's kind of more fun, I would say, because you do get to spend that extra time with each other, learning choreography and singing together. And it's kind of like a bonding experience. So I'm glad it doesn't just fly by.
Now, you've been at this a long time. I understand that your first television show as a regular role was The Royal Family with Red Fox and Della Reese back when you were 5 years old. Did you always know this was something you wanted to do?
Yeah, pretty much. I've always been involved in the entertainment industry, and I've always, you know, been acting and singing, and it was pretty organic and pretty natural, and I feel like, you know, I've just been always doing this, and I'm really good at it, so why not stick with it?
Were you just one of those, when it comes to child actors, there's either the fearless child actor or the precocious child actor. Were you just fearless when you started doing this? I mean, working on a sitcom with a live studio audience and veteran performers, or were you even aware of what you were involved in at that tender age?
Well, I was definitely aware, just because, you know, I would always be running lines with my mom or going, getting headshots taken. So I was definitely aware of the process of it. And I think that I was pretty fearless, as most kids are at that age, no matter what they're involved in. And I think that's actually awesome. And I wish that I had some of that fearlessness now, being 22, just because it's weird how nerves creep up, you know, when you're older and you have a sense of how people perceive you, and I wish I didn't have that.
You are working on a hit show right now. Do you think this could be a long run for you, and are you prepared for that?
You know what? I hope so. I heard that we reached the 1 million download mark on iTunes today,
So that seems like good news to me. I am prepared. I'm prepared to work, and I hope it lasts for a really long time.
Naya Rivera, one of the stars of Glee, which can be seen on both Fox and here in Canada also on Global. Check your local listings. There's more Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming up in just a few moments.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special best of edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the interviews we've done over the 3+ years of the show. And it's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Right now, let's talk a little about cockroaches. Back on Stuff File number 0022, we talked to a man who not only kills them for a living, he also dresses them up. Michael Bodan is an exterminator who runs the Cockroach Hall of Fame and Museum.
I'm a professional exterminator, but I've always kind of been a little weirdo. My ex-wife called me eccentric, and I guess anybody that has a cockroach museum must be a little eccentric.
Well, I was about to say, you do have this cockroach museum, and I've even seen the piece on YouTube about your cockroach museum, and how did this get started, especially considering you were initially a person hired to kill these things?
Well, I tell you what, about 20 years ago, I did a promotion where I made a wanted dead or alive poster, and I offered $1,000 for Dallas's largest cockroach. And the media picked up on it, CNN picked up on it, and pretty soon I was doing interviews around the world. Well, it got a lot of publicity for my store, and people started bringing their cockroaches in. We even had a limo driver bring in the cockroach for someone that didn't want to be known that they were trying to get $1,000. So we finally, after 30 days in August, we measured the cockroach, and there was about 45 cockroaches brought in, and the largest one was 1.88 inches, and we paid $1,000 to three girls at Southwestern Bell. Well, a week later, I get a call from NBC, and the Johnny Carson show wanted me to appear with that cockroach on the show. So I jumped on the plane, went out to Burbank, and I was a guest on a Friday night. His audience was 20 million people at that time. And Ed McMahon said, "Michael, this show's going to change your life." I didn't think anything of it. And I came back to Dallas, and I had 10 job offers to be spokesperson for chemical companies. So I went to work for American Cyanamid, who made a cockroach product. And I had a 5-year contract, and the last 2 years of the contract, I traveled the globe judging contests for the best dressed cockroach in New York and Miami. And when the promotion was done, they were going to throw them away, and I said, heck no, I'm going to make a museum. They gave them to me, and that's how it started.
Now, I understand in your museum you have such cockroaches. For instance, you have Liberace, which of course is...
Liberace, and it actually plays the piano. This was done by an elderly lady, and it's a cockroach at a table, and a piano, I mean, and it's playing the piano, and music actually comes out of the piano. So people really had fun, it's strange, but when people are normally terrified of cockroaches, but when you start dressing them up, they love it.
Well, the same can be said about humans.
That's true. I'm sorry.
What are some of the other themed cockroaches you have at the museum?
Well, I'm looking at them right now. We have the Bates Motel roach, and the guy called it the Combates Motel because the sponsor at that time was Combat. Then we have Boys at the Beach. It's roaches with sunglasses laying on the beach getting a tan, and one on a surfing sun surfer thing. And then we have Ross Perroach. That's kind of funny. Post-NAFTA, and it's a cockroach with Ross Perot's face on it. And then we have Marilyn and Roach. We have Batman Roach. People really had fun with this. And lately, people have been coming from, from different parts of the country. It's amazing how the Internet can make a little micro museum like this infamous.
Admittedly, no one really likes to have a cockroach in their house, and we always make cockroach jokes about the fact that they'll be the only thing around after Armageddon, but there's something to be said about a creature that has basically withstood just about everything the elements and mankind has been able to throw at it.
You are so right. You know, cockroaches have been around for 350 million years. They were around before the dinosaurs, and they're going to last a lot longer than we're going to be around here, and they're just tenacious, and I kind of look up to them. I look at a cockroach, and I have this large, big vat. It's a tub, plastic tub, and I have about 250 large Madagascar hissing cockroaches. And sometimes when I'm bored and I don't have anything else to do, I'll sit in a chair and I just listen and I watch them and watch the interreaction, and they hiss and they talk. And I figure, my gosh, any insect that has been able to last this long, maybe we can learn something from them. So sometimes I'm accused of being a cockroach, a 6-foot cockroach.
I'm just wondering, with the admiration that you have for these creatures, is there ever any concern that you might have some sort of Stockholm syndrome and that you won't be able to do your job and kill them during the day?
Hey, when there's a cockroach in front of my spray rig, they're dead.
Michael Bodan, who runs the Cockroach Hall of Fame and Museum. Yes. In one of my other lives, I spent about 20 years working behind the scenes at Montreal's Just for Laughs Festival. It gives me a chance to hang out and chat with a host of comedians. Which reminds me, you can also check out one of my other shows that I host. It's called SiriusXM's Just for Laughs, and guess what? You can hear it on SiriusXM. Anyway, back to being backstage. One of the many people I've had a chance to work with and talk to is actor and comic Tom Arnold. In between other comics performing in a show that he was hosting, Tom took some time to chat about his career, as heard on Stuff File number 0048. Tom, you've had a great career so far. You've done over 70 films. You've had a sitcom. You've done stand-up. But I sometimes get the feeling that for some reason in your career, you have to keep explaining yourself to people, to either critics or media, who sometimes don't give you the, quite frankly, the due that you deserve. Do you feel that way?
Well, of course, I feel like, you know, sometimes I overdo it, and people are like, why would you worry? Why do you care? Why do you, don't Google your name. Don't pay attention to critics, you've had enough, whatever, you know, and I do feel very blessed. I mean, I worked at a meatpacking plant for 3 years before I did this, and I've had opportunities with 4 or 5 sitcoms, and I've had these other things, but sometimes something I'll take it more personally than I should. I remember once there was this kid that had a website called Tom Arnold is the Devil, and I read about it, and then I ended up contacting this person. I had no idea about them, you know. And it turned out to be a kid that was like 22 and lived in his mother's basement, and he'd had no friends until he had this website called Tom Arnold is the Devil, and now he had a lot of, like 200 friends, and I felt so bad about me, this guy out of nowhere, you know, he's trying to have a little bit of fun, and, you know, I should be able to take that. That's part of the job. And so I was crushing him, and I said, put the site back up. In fact, I'll give you some stuff about proving that I am the devil, and I'll help you get back going. And So I always regret when I say something or do something because it does make me look like an ass because, you know, I have been blessed and I have been lucky. But you know, also the part of being a comedian or being a performer is I think if everything had gone perfect and, you know, it wasn't, if there weren't so many movies people could make fun of and if there weren't so many opportunities, it wouldn't be as interesting. You know, I work hard and I know I am very, very lucky. And so, you know.
Yeah, but you keep saying lucky. You're also talented. Let's not leave that out of it. I mean, and I go back to that big theatrical film you had a couple of years ago when people first saw Tom Arnold in a serious role. And I think a lot of people were surprised. And I thought that would have been the film that would have put you over the hump where people would say, yes, let's take Tom Arnold seriously.
Well, there's been, you know, in the films I've done, it's been like starting with True Lies. True Lies is a movie, a big Hollywood movie that came out right as my divorce, my first divorce, a very public, ugly mess where everybody said he'll never work again. And then this movie comes out that I'd been working on for a year. And people in Hollywood went, oh, they didn't even know me. Said, oh, maybe he is a decent guy. Not that, you know, they'd ever met me, but I was good in a good movie, right? And so that suddenly made me okay. And so there's been times in my career where I've then done too many movies or, you know, thought, oh, I'll never work it. I better take all these movies. I better do this. I better do that. And then, you know, I've had to reboot and, you know, maybe do like independent movies that are more, you know, serious. And you know, if you want to work with John Malkovich, you got to do something serious. And through that, you know, what I call the struggle or whatever, you know, because my biggest fear, the first time I did a serious movie was a movie called that Steve Buscemi directed called, now I'm blanking on the name of it, but Animal Factory. And it was a great movie written by Eddie Bunker and with Mickey Rourke and a bunch of people, Steve and a whole bunch of people, Willem Dafoe, who ended up shivving me. But it was based in a prison. And the fact that I got an opportunity, my fear was people would come to the screening, see me come on as this, you know, this rapist, prison rapist, and then start laughing. But, you know, I got lucky and they accepted me as a prison rapist, which is, I guess, also not necessarily a compliment. But, you know, I got to work with these great actors in this little movie. And so, you know, and lately a lot of the stuff I've done has been very, very serious and personal to me. And, you know, so I think a lot of comics, people that start off in comedy, it's the old phrase that comedy is hard is true. You know, it is harder than, you know, the dramatic stuff.
That was just a small part of a chat with actor and comic Tom Arnold. Now, we could have chatted forever because Tom is just such a warm and giving individual. But we both had work to do backstage, so that chat had to come to an end. And if you want to hear the longer version of that discussion, you can hear it on Stuff File number 0048. Okay, I'm going to go backwards a bit now to Stuff File number 0019. Actor Ray McKinnon was one of the stars of the Sandra Bullock film The Blind Side. He played Coach Cotton. Now, Ray also has an Oscar for a short film that he did, but more on that later. Here's a part of our chat with actor Ray McKinnon. I recently saw the movie The Blind Side, and it is such a sweet movie. The fact that it's a true story doesn't hurt, but it really is such a sweet movie filled with heart.
Absolutely, you know, and it's a lot of times films like those get poo-pooed by the tastemakers, but since this is based on a real story, it makes it a little more difficult. And, you know, life is sometimes sentimental and sweet, and occasionally movies can reflect that. And so I think there was a real hunger for that. We're all surprised at how well it's done. Good gracious. Wish I'd have had points.
As someone who, as I said earlier, acts and directs and produces, you know the whole creative process that goes into putting a film together. What was it like for you playing someone who is actually a real person?
Well, I guess, you know, just getting a call, John Lee Hancock, who wrote and directed the film, adapted it from a book, the true story book, he's a rare bird. He's an admirer of my films, and he said that he wanted us to work together. So he called me and offered me the role of the coach, and and I started reading the script, and this coach role was so good that I was sure there was another coach he was talking about. So I kept looking for the other coach. It's like, no, it's that coach. And it was just a great character. And, you know, he told me that that partly he was writing, you know, he wasn't writing exactly like this coach was. He wanted to, you know, stay away from that. And so he created this character based loosely on the real coach. And I just really interpreted, you know, his writing of that character. But I guess the research that I did, a friend of mine is an actual high school football coach, and I hung out with him and watched him, you know, deal with the kids every day. And it was so anytime I look really goofy or stupid, it's all because of my friend, the real coach.
Now, you have a recognizable face. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with your work if they see you, that you've done such characters as Reverend H.W. Smith in the television series Deadwood. You've done a lot of episodic television. But you're probably, as a character actor, certainly not a household name. Do you get that any weird reactions from people when they meet you, when they, first of all, don't realize that you're an actor that they may have seen on television or in the movies, but they think you're somebody they know?
Yeah, usually they think I'm their plumber, and they start telling me the problems with their running commode, and like, yeah, it's that happens a lot, and that's it's kind of nice to be somewhat anonymous, and I like that. I like I do the same thing when I see somebody who's an actor that your subconscious is kind of funny because there's this imprint on your brain, like, I know I've seen that guy, I must know him. And then you realize, oh, wait a minute, he's an actor. So, yeah, that happens. That happens fairly often.
And even so, I didn't introduce you the correct way, because I believe the correct way to introduce you is Academy Award-winning Ray McKinnon, because you have an Oscar.
I guess Academy Award winning former DUI gathering. There's a lot of ways, a lot of things you could add, but yeah, we'll leave some of them out. Yeah, that did happen. You know, my wife Lisa Blunt and our producing partner Walton Goggins and I made a short film a few years ago called The Accountant. And really, it was just, I wanted to make a film. And I figured we could handle a short film, and it just, you know, went all the way to the award. So that was a rather surreal experience.
Actor, producer, director, and Academy Award winner Ray McKinnon, one of the stars of the film The Blind Side. Now, Ray mentioned his wife, fellow Oscar winner and Golden Globe nominee Lisa Blount. She was probably best known for her role as Lynette Pomeroy in the film An Officer and a Gentleman. We had a chance to catch up with Lisa on Stuff File number 0061. At the time, she was very excited about a television pilot she was working on for FX called Outlaw Country. And sadly, she would never get the chance to do that show. Lisa died on October 27th, 2010, at the age of 53, less than a month after we had talked. Here's a bit of that conversation now. What is Outlaw Country about?
Well, the title essentially reflects the at least from my character's point of view, we have a family of they're called the Larkins, and they are outlaws. They have always operated outside the law and always will. So this story takes place in a fictitious backwoods town in the state of Tennessee, where the Larkins do their business. The head of the family, played by John Hawkes, he's a wonderful and amazing actor, truly, truly wonderful. And then the other side is another family with Mary Steenburgen playing the lead in that family. She's from this small town, but got away and did well, and now she's come home. Now we have our Romeo and Juliet story, where the young man playing my son meets up with the young lady playing her daughter, and though they've been warned that these people don't mix, they fall in love immediately, of course, as young people tend to do. So that's essentially, I think, what this show is about. What I love about the show is that it's such an ensemble piece. There really are an awful lot of characters and storylines being developed.
Now, you mentioned on the onset that you decided to go back to work. So had you stopped working for a while?
Well, yes and no. The last time I worked for someone other than myself was in 2003. So for me, this really was a big back-to-work sort of thing. My husband and myself and another FX actor, our partner Walton Goggins, began making our own projects. Starting with The Accountant in 2000, and then we made some feature films. So that's where I put my energies and my efforts, and then working with my husband on several writing projects. There just wasn't anything that I was aware of that interested me. I was much more interested in moving back to Arkansas and getting reacquainted with my family, in a way other than just flying into town a few times a year. So that to find something that was Southern-centric, possibly to be shot near, my home, all of that was very, very appealing. And also, I love playing these kinds of characters. Donna is yet another sort of trashy gal, but there's always a way to find the other side of the woman, some sort of why is she this way, to humanize her, to shine a light maybe on the heart of a person like this, who on a superficial level just looks like a bad woman. And there certainly are women out there like that, but most all of them, at least in their own minds, have justifications for their bad behavior. And Donna definitely has that.
Well, you say you like to play these types of characters, so I've got to ask, and please don't hurt me, is there a little bit of the trashy gal in Lisa Blunt?
That's a very, very good question. And no, to be honest with you, I'm a very straightforward person. I am always, I just can't believe the crazy outfit they put me in because I would never, ever know to think of those kinds of costumes, much less, choose to wear them.
Actress Lisa Blount, who died too soon and never got the chance to star in Outlaw Country. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best of retrospective look at some of the interviews we've had on over the years. That's coming up in just a bit.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I know this may sound silly, but have you ever considered eating a Christmas tree? No? Well, me neither. But believe it or not, someone once sent me a warning label they found on a Christmas tree that actually said, "Caution, not for human consumption." As the creator of the annual Wacky Warning Label Contest, I see a lot of unusual labels like that every year, especially during the holidays. You may have seen some too. A lot of the gifts we give each other are plastered with warning labels. And let's be fair, some are downright silly. But one of those labels will be worth $1,000. That's right, each year the Center for America awards cash prizes to the people who find the wackiest warning labels in America. And the grand prize is $1,000. So, this holiday season, be sure to keep an eye out for those outrageous common sense warning labels. To enter our contest, visit our website at centerforamerica.org. And on behalf of everyone at the Center for America, happy holidays.
Inform or entertain? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
Still to come on this special retrospective of the 3 years of The Stuff File program, we'll have one of my favorite idiots of the day, but let's go back a bit to talk about a very hot pizza. It was back on Stuff File number 0136. Hell Pizza in New Zealand had a hot new promotion, literally. They were offering Kiwis a gut-wrenching, mouth-watering, tear-jerking trip for their taste buds. They created pizza roulette, a sort of Russian roulette where one slice of pizza had two drops of a very potent hot sauce added to it. Hell Pizza's co-director, Stu McMullen, who also organized this campaign, told us about it from New Zealand.
We've got a bit of a history of being quite immature in the kitchen. And many years ago, we used to, whenever it would come time for the end of the night with our staff and we'd be making them their dinner, because we'd always give them dinner at the end of the shift. Callum and I would always try to spice their pizza up or do particular things to them or lace them with things or put fish oil on it or do anything just to kind of mess around with our staff. So then it just all kind of evolved from there. We thought, hey, what a great idea. Why don't we just mess up one slice and then turn it on the rest of our customers? I tell you what, it went crazy. We launched it. All we did was actually put it on our Facebook page, and then we've got an internal email database with all our customers in New Zealand. We launched it on there, and then within literally a day, it was on New York Times, Time Magazine, CNN. It's been like the headline story in Taiwan on their main news network. It's just gone crazy.
The people in New Zealand have to have a good sense of humor about this. The reason why I say that, I know in some countries, certainly in some states in the United States, people would be so quick to want to cause or start a lawsuit over this. Some people just don't have a sense of humor. Are you worried about that? Do you have to concern yourself with liabilities of any kind?
No, it's certainly New Zealand's not as litigious as America or Canada, for sure. But no, I mean, we certainly were worried because we're conscious of the fact that we used to do it to other people and screw with other people. So we thought, well, other people might do it to their friends as well. So for that reason, what we did was every time you order a Pizza Roulette pizza online or through the point of sale, we have a disclaimer on there. So we say, hey, look, you have to agree to these terms and conditions. And then when we actually finish the whole pizza, we seal the box closed with a sticker, and it acts in a way like software. So we came up with the idea from software packaging. You know, if you tear open this package, you agree to the terms and conditions. Well, it's pretty much along the same lines as that. If you tear open the pizza box, you've read the terms and conditions. You know what you're doing inside there.
Now, do I understand that you can actually turn part of the box into a small coffin?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And on the back it says, for your remains.
And I love the tagline, it doesn't cost, but someone pays.
It's pure gold. The thing with this campaign is, you know, as a retailer, is it works on so many levels. It has, like I say, it doesn't cost, but someone pays. It's a great message to get out there to people. It's social media. It's people playing with the actual game and videoing themselves and putting it up on social network sites. It upsells, which is fantastic. People, instead of buying a small pizza, will buy a big pizza. So everything about the mechanic of this whole promotion just works. You do so many things in business, and then sometimes you just hit on that one thing that just goes really well.
Stu McMullen, co-director of Hell Pizza. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0175, and you'll find links to their website, which also has the video of the cricket team playing pizza roulette. On Stuff File number 0148, we had a member of Starfleet on the show. This year happened to be the 25th anniversary of Star Trek The Next Generation. On that show, Marina Sirtis gained worldwide acclaim as the sexy and cerebral Deanna Troi, the half-human, half-betazoid empath who was the Enterprise's counselor. Marina talked about auditioning for the role.
I did 6 auditions over the course of 6 weeks. And the first 3, I was auditioning for Tasha. And Denise was auditioning for Troi. And 3 auditions in, they switched us. So, you know what? I'm saying that. I actually have never asked Denise if she auditioned for Troi. We may have both been up for the same part at the beginning. That's kind of interesting, too. But they did switch me after 3 because they sensed an empathy in me that the character needed. What they actually sensed was the sheer terror of I was just so scared at that point. That I was going to do something and screw up this great job and opportunity, but it wasn't empathy. I was absolutely just terrified.
Now you had come over from the UK, so you weren't necessarily deeply entrenched in this whole Star Trek franchise phenomena, even though it wasn't as big before The Next Generation started as it later became, but still. There was something to it. There were a lot of fans. So you had no idea what you were stepping into, did you?
No. I mean, I knew, of course I knew what Star Trek was. I mean, you'd have to live in a cave in the 20th century not to know, the late 20th century, to not know what Star Trek was. But I'd never seen the show. But, I kind of I think I vaguely knew, I had this like vague idea that there was something out there that could involve fans. But I really didn't know. To me, it was this amazing job. I was guaranteed a year's work, which was going to be the longest job I'd ever had on television. So I was just happy thus far. You know, it was that was great. The rest was almost like a wonderful bonus.
As a matter of fact, were you not at the time of the audition just basically at the end of your visa rope?
Oh, I was at the end of every rope. I was broke. My credit cards were all maxed out. I had a return ticket back to London, which I had to use if I didn't get the job, because otherwise I had no money to pay for another ticket. So, and my visa ran out the day after I was offered the job. So for about 3 weeks until I got my new visa, I was an illegal. I know. Lucky I wasn't living in Arizona, huh?
Absolutely. Now, so you get this character, you're on the show for its run. As I said, you weren't necessarily familiar with the whole Star Trek phenomena when you started. So what was it like when you first started meeting fans and realized that to some people this is practically a religion?
Well, on a certain level, I get it, because I am a soccer fanatic, right? The same way that Star Trek fans love Star Trek, I love soccer. I mean, if I could earn money watching soccer, that would be my ideal job. So I totally understand the passion, and I totally understand, you know, the kind of devotion that the fans have for us, because I have it for some, you know, soccer players and teams and things. So I kind of get it on that level. I really do, because I get as stupid around some soccer things as some of the fans get around me. So I understand it. However, I didn't think that I would be on the receiving end of that kind of adoration. I must be honest. That was a shock.
What's your favorite soccer team?
It's Tottenham Hotspur. And I actually have their emblem tattooed on my body. That's how fanatical I am.
Wow.
That's the only tattoo I have, and it's the logo of my team.
That's a fan.
Yeah. So I get it. You see, I totally get it. So maybe that's why, I don't know, I feel a real rapport with the fans, and maybe, I don't know, I really appreciate what they do for us, and you know, like I said, I'm in the same boat a lot of the time.
As a classically trained actor, did you commiserate with that other classically trained actor, Patrick Stewart, when you first got into the starship world, doing those scenes in those outfits? What was it like for the two of you?
Well, you know what? Patrick always used to say that, you know, whatever it was, 37 years at the Royal Shakespeare Company was the training for him to play, playing all those kings and dukes, you know, was the training for him to play Captain Picard. Because like on stage, you don't have pockets when you do Shakespeare. We didn't have pockets. We didn't have, you know, the way that you stand on stage when you're doing Shakespeare, when it's all about the words and it's all about the emotions, that's kind of exactly what it was like on Star Trek. Apart from the occasional prop, it was always just about the words and the emotions. And I think we, the two of us, had a little bit of an edge on some of the Americans because of that, because we were used to it.
Actress Marina Sirtis, best known as Deanna Troi from Star Trek: The Next Generation. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is, again, show number 0175, and you'll find links to Marina's website. You can also go to my YouTube page and find a video slideshow version of the full interview, along with other celebrity slideshow interviews that I've created. I hope you've enjoyed this look back at the best of the Stuff File program. I'm actually surprised at how difficult it was to decide what didn't go into the show, because I had a lot to choose from. Of course, all previous Stuff File programs are available online, so you can listen to them whenever you'd like. I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off, so let's get to it. Time now for our Retro Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff-Off presents the Idiot of the Day.
This gem comes from Stuff File number 0118 back in November 2011. 20-year-old Brent Morgan was arrested in Prince George, British Columbia in October 2011 on three counts related to the attempted theft of a Corvette. Morgan had seen the car in a driveway, jumped in, and locked the doors. However, the owner had been in the process of charging the battery, which was still too weak for the car to start and for the door locks to continue working. Feeling trapped and sensing that the owner was about to call the police or maybe he had already done so, Morgan panicked and began using any available tool inside the car to smash the window. According to the police report, officers arrived just as Morgan had broken open the driver's side window, but too late for Morgan to realize that he could have exited the car by manually lifting the door locks with his fingers. Why? Couldn't he just turn and unlock the door with his hands? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0175, our retro best of show. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's number 0175. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for our best of show. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.